So thanks a lot for the invitation and for the opportunity. It's always a pleasure to be here. And actually, the title of my talk, it's directly inspired by an event that I attended here when I was a student some years ago. And I found it very interesting and inspiring because of the connection between low energy and high energy physics. And the talk is indeed a very nice example of how this connection can be fruitful. And for two reasons. So the first reason is because my first picture was actually fake, I took one by myself yesterday to make sure that this was okay. And just to say that this place is always really inspiring, so you're quite lucky to be here, and I always enjoy to be here. But let's get to the physics. So what I'm telling you today, it's part of a long program that we have started some years ago. It started deep into the holographic framework, and it ended up almost in pure condensed and soft matter. And as you can see, there are a lot of collaborators. Some of them are here, and some of them are purely condensed matter people. So here, this already wants to, you know, emphasize the interplay between low energy and high energy. But let me tell you a bit more of what I have for you today. So what I'm basically trying to convince you is that holography, not in its high energy sense, can be very useful for understanding condensed matter problem. And I want to think as holography as some kind of effective field theory tool, such that the full picture that, let's say, nature provides us, it's just the full pizza, and holography is just a part of the pizza. And I want to emphasize that condensed matter should be the last part of the pizza, so the more tasteful and the one you will remember, because it's actually the task, so what we want to really tackle. So holography for me is just a nice tool. We can, you know, fill up a lot of blackboards. But then the real task and the hard work is not really solving our equation, but it's making them useful for something like data that we have at low energy. And to emphasize a bit more the big distinction between high energy and low energy, I want to just give you an idea of which are the scales I will talk about. So as high energy physicists, we are very used to talk about GeV, which is supposed to be very high energy. What I will tell you about today has to do with energy, which are basically at the scale of the MeV. So a big order, let's say, difference in magnitude. And also, we are usually, let's say, used or taught to think about very high energetic or very distant objects like black holes. We are always discussing black holes. They are very interesting. But what I'm telling you today, it's something actually much closer to your everyday experience. And it's just about basically glasses and viscoelastic material like Annie. And I will try to convince you why these kind of problems are very interesting, even though they lie very close to ourselves, and maybe they're not so fancy as this kind of problem. But I also will try to convince you how studying these kind of theories, we can learn something about this kind of objects. So the long-term target of this program, it's very simple. Actually, apparently, it's very simple, but it's far from being trivial. And it's basically classifying all the different phases of matter that we have around ourselves every day. And this is not a trivial question. This is actually, there is a funny anecdote that just when I came here, I was at the airport, and at the security, they stopped me, and they asked me, do you have any liquids? And there was like a very nice picture of what is a liquid. I didn't take a picture because I was a bit shy, but I realized by myself that the question I've been asked was actually very pertinent to the talk I was giving. And as I will show you after, this kind of question, it's far from trivial. So I already encourage you at the beginning of the talk, and then we will see the answer at the end, to think, what is the difference between the solid and the liquid, in your opinion? So to be a bit more precise, the specific problem that we will tackle today has to do with the vibrational modes of matter. And in particular, which are the physical properties that are deeply connected with these vibrational modes? This is nothing else than the heat capacity and thermal transfer. And for simplicity, I will focus on three different classes of material, explain you what they are, so solid, glasses, and liquids. So let's start from the basics. This is just the basics of solid state, but since most of us are from high energy, and to make this connection more solid, we really have to start from here. So imagine you have a solid, and as a solid, I mean an order crystal. So here I have a crystal that here I, for example, draw in configuration in momentum space, which is periodic. For the moment, forget about any defects, impurities, or whatever else you want to think about it. Now, if you take this problem, you realize that actually the vibrational degrees of freedom are nothing else than plane waves. So at least in the limit of low energy, so low momenta, these are nothing else than what we call phonon or sound. So these are Goldstone mode for translation. They are massless, and they have a linear dispersion relation. And the linear terms is exactly the speed of sound of the material. So I basically do a vibration on this table. These sounds start to propagate, and these vibrational modes are exactly the modes that propagates this sound. Okay? And of course, these modes will not propagate forever at high energy, but there should be a cutoff. And the cutoff physically is very easy to understand. It's just basically when the wavelength of this mode becomes comparable to the lattice space. Okay? At that point, this kind of description does not make any sense anymore, and you can think about this omega, which is nothing, is called like the bifrequency, as the UV cutoff of your, okay, which is basically the lattice space. Now, if you start with this problem, it's very easy to compute what is called the density of state. So what is the density of state? The word says already, it's just how many state of a certain energy I can put, I mean, I will find in my system. And I can compute it very easy. Here I just sketch the steps. What you have to do is just really counting in momentum space how many states you can put in a sphere of momentum, okay? And assuming the linear dispersion relation, you will get an immediate answer, which is very easy to derive, and which says that the density of state of, let's say, the phonon or the vibrations in the system are proportional to the square of the frequency. And the proportionality constant is indeed related to the speed. Here, for simplicity, I assume that we are in an isotropic system with two transverse direction and one longitudinal. And this is nothing else than the longitudinal speed of sound, and this is the speed of transverse sound. And this is just a volume that you can forget about. Now, this is very efficient. And here I just show you an example why this kind of computation, despite being very simple, it's very efficient to compute physical properties of real material. Here, for example, I took the heat capacity, the specific heat of a material. So accordingly to Debye theories, to the formula that we just drew before, the heat capacity at low temperature should go like the cubic power of the temperature. And here you can see a plot of, for example, the extrapolation of this formula to various data. So as you can see here, the material are very different from itself because the Debye temperature, so basically the microscopic structure of the material, it's very different. So the Debye temperature varies in a huge range. But still, when I normalize appropriately the physical quantities and I draw the data, they all lie on a line. And the line is exactly very well approximated by the Debye. So still here, very good. We understand very well the thermal properties of solid, the specific heat, the vibrational mode, blah, blah, blah. So we are fine. But then there is a problem. And the problem comes immediately when we consider something slightly different. And by something slightly different, I just mean glasses. So you don't have to think about very, you know, fancy glasses. You can just think, for example, about silica or some very simple glass, everyday life. And if you do the same computation, so you compute the density of state and how experimentally you do, you can do it basically in two ways. One is Raman scattering. So you basically check the photons. And the other one is neutron scattering. So you throw basically a neutron and you see how it scatters in the material. And you can draw basically the intensity. You see, for example, this is a Raman experiment, the Raman intensity. And it's very customary to normalize it by the omega square. So here, these are all plots of basically the density of state normalized by the omega square. And what you see here is that if those material would obey Debye, that would be just a line. It would be just a line, and the line would be just the speed of sound. But as you can see here, all this material universally show an anomaly around 1 terahertz in frequency and some MeV in energy, which is very universal, and it appears in all this material, meaning that there is an excess of state at that point. Now, the question is, the Debye model fails. This feature, which actually is called boson peak, it's very universal. How can we explain this feature? And this feature is also connected to more anomalies that appear in this system. And of course, the anomalies reflect themselves immediately in the heat capacity and the thermal conductivity because they are basically just objects built through the density of state. They are just some kind of integral of the density of state. And here you can see, for example, the comparison between a solid, like a crystal, an ordered crystal like alpha quartz, and a glass, like silica. Okay? And you can see the difference. So first of all, in the heat capacity, usually, as I showed you before, the heat capacity starts like cubic in a crystal, in an ordered crystal. But in glasses, it starts linear. There is a linear contribution that you can see. Well, you cannot see maybe very good here, but I swear there is. And this contribution is unexpected, and it's again due to the fact that there is an effect of state in the density of state. At the same time, you can see how the thermal conductivity of a crystal and of a glass are very different between themselves. Okay? So now the question is again, can we explain all these features? And the answer is, let's say yes. So there are a lot of models. This actually, it's a very huge topic in condensed matter. It has been studied in the last basically 50, 60 years. And here you can see a lot of models that try to explain this feature. The point is that all these models rely on some assumption of disorder. Because these amorphous solid or these glasses can be thought as material with a lot of disorder, okay? So now the point is that, okay, the thing seems conclusive, right? We have a lot of different models that explain the feature we see. We are fine. But we are not. We are not because more recently, there have been at least three and increasing number of experimental observation of the same phenomena in ordered crystal. So in order crystal with no disorder, no defects, no impurity. And now the question is, if there is no disorder, we have again to start from the beginning because we have no theory available to explain what's happening. So the talk of today will try to give you a simple, very simple motivation why this kind of XX should be quite universal and not related just to disorder material. And there is also more. There is also more, and the fact is basically that there is another unexplained feature of this peak, which is how this peak moves when I change the density of the material. Here you can see a cartoon. So this is the peak we are talking about. And when I change the density of the material, and especially I increase the density of the material, these are the experimental data, the intensity of the peak decreases, and the peak moves at higher energy. And this feature, there is no available model that can actually confirm it and explain it in a, let's say, robust and solid way. So now, why I'm giving this talk to all of you, which are much more familiar with holography, and why I've been scheduled from strings or quantum field theory. So the reason why is that we came towards the solution that I'm going to present you, starting indeed from holography and from studying the vibrational states of matter in holographic systems. So you are pretty familiar with what is holography. In general, the only thing that I want you to assume here is that we have a very nice tool and that a single, let's say, you know, single system can be described in two different ways. And for certain reason, the solid state part appears to be very hard, and therefore we're just trying to ask our friends of the general relativity group, if they can help us. That's all I want you to know about holography so far. Now, just as an introduction, I have to explain you a bit how we encode in holography the spontaneous breaking of translation, and therefore we get basically the phonons. This is a work that we have started some years ago, and it starts all with the idea of how to introduce the breaking of translation. So as you know, in the holographic dictionary, the conservation of the stress tensor is deeply connected with the diffeomorphous invariance in the bulk. Therefore, if I want to break the conservation of the stress energy tensor and I want momentum to be relaxed, I have to break diffeomorphous invariance in the bulk. And the easiest way to break diffeomorphous invariance in the bulk is just giving a mass to the gravity.
Excuse me.
Yep.
In all the examples you gave, quantum was behind because mostly a classical phenomenon, vibration. Now you are bringing in holography,
yeah,
where quantum is essential. Is that meaningful?
Well, you will see at the level of what I'm telling you, quantum is not really essential. So for example, when we talk about vibrational degrees of freedom like Goldstone mode, I just need a symmetry that I break. And just by the symmetry breaking pattern, things will happen.
But in the holographic context, don't you have quantum at the root of it? No.
Well, I mean, if you want to think about it, also the theory of phonon, like Debye theory or Einstein theory, is quantum. You have to quantize the phonon to get the heat capacity, right? So it's not exactly, we are not treating the phonon as a classical particle, right? For example, the computation that I showed you before, where you get the T to the cube, you have to assume that every quanta of phonons has an energy of H bar omega, which is clearly quantum, okay? But most of the physics does not rely very strongly on actually this kind of fact, okay? So now, just to go back to the what we want to do, we will break basically translation, putting a graviton, putting a mass to the graviton, and this graviton mass will basically mimic the presence of a relaxation time for momentum, such that the conservation of the stress tensor is going to be modified in this simple way. Okay, so the stress tensor is not conserved anymore; it will relax at a time scale which is given by basically the mass of the graviton. Now, importantly, we have to separate between two things. So the first thing is the explicit breaking of translation. So imagine you have some kind of structure, like heavy structure, like some impurities or some defects that is not moving, is there, and it's breaking translation. This will be nothing else than basically deforming my Hamiltonian with a space-dependent term. And this is not what I want to tell you about. So forget about this case. But let's concentrate on a different case. So the case of spontaneous symmetry breaking, when actually the object which is breaking translation is an expectation value of an operator. In this case, we have the spontaneous symmetry breaking of translation, and we are guaranteed to have phonons, and phonons comes together with elastic properties. Okay? Now, skipping all the details of the model, let's just go to the results. So this is a pure holographic result, and what I'm showing you are basically the vibrational states of the system, of the holographic system. How I do that? I do that looking at the poles, or if you want, at the quasi-normal mode of the stress tensor operator. So I use the usual prescription from holography, and I compute the quasi-normal mode. This is the transverse sector, and that's what I get. So let's go through what I get. So clearly, if you concentrate on the real part of this mode, you see a nice linearly, let's say, increasing mode, which is nothing else than our phonons. And you can see that the speed of the phonon is actually dependent on the graviton mass, on the parameter. And more precisely, on the dimensional ratio between the graviton mass and the temperature. But there is more. So first of all, the speed, you can easily check that is given by the elastic modulus as it should be. And the elastic modulus can be obtained independently from its Kubo formula. So again, from the stress energy tensor. And it's very nice to see that the two computations agree perfectly. So basically, you don't see here, but the data that we get from the quasi-normal mode numerically, and just this formula agrees 100%. Now, there is another funny thing, that we started with the aim of describing just pure phonons, but then we ended up discovering something that we already knew, which is in holography, every time we're doing holography, we have an horizon. Every time we have an horizon, we have some temperature effects coming in, and therefore some viscosity coming. So it's clear that what we are really mimicking, it's not a pure crystal, but it's something more closer to a viscoelastic material. And that's why our phonon here are not exactly phonon, but they have also an imaginary part, a diffusive part, whose diffusion constant is indeed determined basically by the shear viscosity. And this is exactly what you see in the imaginary part. Okay, very nice. So now you can extend this, and that's what we are after these days, to the longitudinal sector. And in the longitudinal sector, what you will discover is that, again, also the longitudinal phonons will have a speed which is proportional this time not only to the shear elastic modulus but also to the bulk modulus, and a diffusion constant or sound attenuation, which is, for example, showed here. Interestingly enough, since we are considering a conformal field theory, there is a strong relation between the two speeds which can be verified numerically. Now, why I'm telling you all these stories? I'm telling you all these stories because then, if you take the holographic model and you're going to compute the heat capacity or the specific heat, so this is very easily computable from holography just doing T ds dt. And this is the specific heat. And that's what you discover. So if I compute the specific heat in this model, I discover that at large temperature, this is just going like T to the d, which is Debye, or if you want, just dimensionality in a conformal field theory. But when you deform your conformal field theory and you go to very low temperature, you will see that the scaling gets modified. And gets modified in a way that it becomes exactly linear in temperature. So interestingly enough, the transition between the two regimes happens exactly when the phonon stops to propagate. So what I mean when the phonon stops to propagate, that of course, as you have seen before, you have generically two contributions. So of course, if there is no this contribution would be absent, this will propagate forever. But at a certain point, when you increase energy, you increase momentum, this diffusive part becomes important. And at a certain point, the phonon stops to propagate ballistically, like propagating particle, and they start just to be diffused away. And when this happens, that's exactly the temperature, or let's say the T over M, at which this transition happens. Now, interestingly, of course, when we saw this, we thought, wait, this feature is something very typical in all the examples that I showed you before, so in glasses and amorphous material. So can it be that I can just explain what I see in the glasses just using the intuition that I get from holography? And the intuition that I get from holography is that maybe I don't have to consider a pure propagating mode, but I have to consider also some kind of diffusive contribution to the mode. So the idea, in other way, it's very, very simple. So the idea is that instead of considering the pure Debye model, where the phonons are just linear dispersion, they have just a linear dispersion relation, I now modify the dispersion relation in order to get a diffusive part. So this, the ints for this dispersion relation, of course, in our case came from holography, but they didn't just come from holography. It was already discussed in the realm of actually condensed matter, and the transition between these two regimes, the new modes appearing in this range were called diffusons. So in order to understand a bit better the model, we have to ask ourselves where the diffusion come from. Because as we will see, the diffusion plays a very important role. So in holography, we know where it comes from. It comes from just from finite temperature effects, from the fact that we have an horizon, and no matter what we want to do, that horizon will be there. In a disordered system, diffusions and damping comes just from disorder. Why? Because you can imagine that you are somebody moving in this material, and then disorder becomes very important. So that means that you will be scattered every once and then, and the scattering is so strong that at a certain point you won't propagate anymore. You will just diffuse around. Now, where it comes from in order crystal? So in order crystal, it was proven a long time ago. There is a very nice computation, if you can read the Russians, in Landau. And so the damping comes just from anharmonic interaction. So even if you have an ordered crystal, you will have a damping. Okay? So basically, the whole idea is that there is no need of disorder to have damping. You will have damping also in an ordered crystal. And now I will guide you through the computation because they're so simple that I want just you to see them. And I will start from nothing else than Newton's law. So this is Newton's law written in terms of what we call the displacement. So the infinitesimal deformation of our solid, and this is just the stress. Now, the important thing, forget about external forces, I'm not putting any external forces, but the important thing is that the stress will have an elastic contribution, which can be generically written in terms of the elastic coefficient, and most importantly, a viscous term, a dissipative term. And the dissipative term will be generically proportional, of course, to the time derivative, because it's dissipative. And generically, there would be a tensor, which I would call the viscous tensor. But let's say in isotropic situation, this would be just nothing else than basically the shear viscosity. Okay? So we are quite familiar, especially when we do holography, this kind of term. We are not very familiar to these terms, but with the model that we implemented, you can actually get a contribution from also this term, and therefore a full, let's say, viscoelastic situation. Okay? Now, if you plug inside these expressions into this equation, and you basically differentiate between the longitudinal sector and the transverse sector, you will get an equation, actually two equations, which looks like a damped harmonic oscillator. And from that, you can read immediately the Green function. So the Green function for these modes will look like this. And more specifically, for the model I'm considering, I will have just a linear dependent term here. And in the damping term, I will have just a diffuse. Now, more specifically, you can relate all the coefficients that appear here, so the speed and the diffusion constant, to more, let's say, microscopic or hydrodynamic quantities, like the viscosities. So this is the shear viscosity, this is the bulk viscosity, this is the energy density. This is the shear modulus, the elastic modulus, and this is the bulk one. So all the system is just described by basically the elastic moduli and the viscosity, nothing else. Now, the last step is just to realize that I can write down the density of states in terms of the imaginary parts of this Green function. And when I do that, I just simply take my expression here and plug it inside this integral. This integral is simple enough to actually be computed analytically and to get an expression in terms of the digamma function, this side here. The form itself is not really important. I just show you because it's analytical, and in this sector, it's not so easy to get analytical things. But the important thing is actually what we get from that. And this is the general picture. So let me guide you. So this is the density of state normalized by the frequency square. So if there is no damping, so if I put all the damping and all the viscosity to zero, what I get is basically just the Debye level. So this constant and this constant is just given by the speed of sound. Now, on the contrary, if I forget totally about the propagating parts and I just compute the diffusion contribution, I will get this gray line. So this gray line wants to grow towards low frequency and, of course, is dominant at high energy because it's k squared, okay? So if I put together the two things, you can already guess what you will get, and you get exactly something like this, where at low energy or low frequency, the Debye term is the one winning, but then at a certain point, the other one becomes relevant and wants to grow, and you produce exactly this. So basically, what we show here is that the peak, so this anomaly, comes just very universally from the competition between a propagating mode, an elastic mode, and a viscous part, a viscous term, which is damping. And here we also show another interesting thing, which is related to the experiments, which is which of the two contributions between the transverse and the longitudinal are actually the most important. So the blue is the transverse contribution, and the green yellowish is the longitudinal contribution. So what we learn from here is that the longitudinal contribution to the peak is basically completely negligible. So why is that? Of course, you can tell me, look, you just show me an expression with a lot of parameters. I can certainly hook up a model where actually the opposite will happen, right? But we know that in all the materials, and we can look at the formulas, that the speed of the longitudinal sound is much higher than the speed of the transverse sound. And that's exactly the reason why who is winning in this peak is the transverse sound. Because the speed of the longitudinal is so big that basically the deformation coming from the damping is completely irrelevant. And therefore, you see this contribution is almost constant, apart from a small bump here in the middle.
Sorry, I had a question about this Green's function. So you wrote down the denominator, it was quadratic and q squared, so it's some kind of universal form. Mm-hmm. But in practice, I guess there will be small corrections, right, for q4 or something.
Yes.
And but this result relies on integrating over the whole range of momenta. So he argued that those things are unimportant.
Yeah. So you can argue that basically, so these effects here that we are discussing, this boson peak, is a low energy effect, which happen at low frequency. In every real material, what you will see, you won't see something constant like this by, because at a certain point, you will become more energetic, and you will get into a mess, because of course, the approximation of the photon, like being linear, is just a low energy. If you see really a dispersion relation or a plot, you will see basically something like this. So you will see basically the various zone of the material, and then you will see the approximation of the phonon, and then a mess here, okay? So what we are discussing and what is relevant for this is basically here. And the deformation that you are saying are exactly basically the deformation that appears basically here at high energy and high momentum. So basically all the physics here is governed by the low energy limit. And of course, you can ask me, what happened if you deform it with more low energy things? For example, it could have a mass. The phonon could have a mass. Of course, it's a phonon, it's a Goldstone boson, so it won't get a mass. But if you put a mass, of course, then yes, you are going to modify this because it will be even more low energetic with respect to the other. But if you put q to the 6, maybe you will modify a bit here. But this feature here will be almost completely independent. So now, how am I doing with time? Okay, so another feature, which is basically still encoded in what I showed you before, is basically to understand how these peaks move with increasing the elastic part. So this is already basically encoded in what we were discussing before, and the visible thing is that increasing the elastic part, these peaks become smaller and smaller, and we move at high energy. That means that, of course, the smallest, the elastic part, the bigger compared to the elastic part is the damping or diffusive part, and therefore the peak wants to grow and wants to be bigger and go closer and closer to the origin. Okay? This is nothing else than that. And this is, of course, measured and checked in the experiments. Now, another interesting thing is related to what is called the Joffe-Regel frequency. So let me tell you just very briefly, for those of you who are not familiar with the quantity, what is that? So I told you before that the phonons, if they have diffusive, imagine you have a mode which is propagating, but it has also diffusive contribution. At a certain point, as we were saying before, at high energy, this mode will stop propagating and will just diffuse. So the Joffe-Regel frequency is nothing else than the frequency, the energy scale at which these things happen. Nothing else than that. So now, why I'm plotting this? Because there was a lot of rumor, let's say, in the literature, discussing a correlation between the position of the peak in the density of state and this frequency. And what we see is exactly that there is a correlation, at least in our model. So here, what I'm plotting is the Joffe-Regel frequency for the transverse sector divided by the boson peak frequency. And what you see is that and I'm plotting in function of the shear modulus, the shear elastic modulus divided by the bulk modulus. So when I'm going at low value of this parameter, I see that there is a correlation, meaning that basically these two quantities are close to one. So why I'm actually putting in shade this area? Because if you take mostly all of the materials that we know in the world, this ratio, it's very small. So usually the shear elastic modulus is always much smaller than the bulk. So the realistic material lies here. Of course, my model can extrapolate, you know, the prediction everywhere. But what is very nice is that in that limit, there is a correlation between the two things. Now, as a last thing, I told you that there was a dependence on the density of the system, which was not understood. And luckily enough, when we plot, let's say, the dependence of the peak in our model in function of the density of the system, what we observe is exactly what we were seeing before in the experiments. So basically increasing the density of the system, the intensity of the peak drops off and it moves slightly at high energy. And here you can see, for example, a plot of the intensity of the peak in function of the density. Notice that in order to have this computation well done, you cannot assume that the viscosities and elastic moduli are independent of the density of the system. So what we had to do is basically go searching in the literature what is the dependence of the viscosity and on the elastic modulus in function of the density. There are experiments and you can see fit. Then once you assume that, you plug it inside your full formula. Your formula will have a very nasty dependence on the density, and what you will see is exactly this kind of behavior. So as far as I understood, this is the first, let's say, explanation available about this kind of phenomena in glasses and the order crystals. So just to conclude the first part, so we got inspired from holographic results. That's why I emphasized before a lot that, you know, high energy physicists can also contribute to low energy problems. And what I show you is just a very simple model from first principle that describes why this boson peak should be universal and should appear not only in disordered system and glasses, but also in ordered crystals. So there are no assumptions of the microscopics, and of course there is a lot of work still to be done, and no disorder is needed. And one thing that I want to emphasize from my side, since we are all familiar with holography, is that lately I like to think a lot about the fact that holography has not to be true or wrong or whatever you want to think about it. Holography has just to be useful. So this is, for example, one case where it has been useful for something very close, for some problem which is very close to us. Now, you... Yes?
Before you move, are you going to conclude more on this part? I just want to comment.
Yep.
For example, many of the anomalies that you pointed out in conventional, as you also pointed out, how microscopic explanations, for example, non-harmonic interactions, are two-level systems and constrained motions in glasses.
Exactly.
So that fits with the phenomenology. Now, when we see the holographic world as a condensed physicist, we are lost. Because you have a horizon, somebody from beyond gives you whatever you want. So, I mean, I'm just trying to...
Yeah.
So this is even a non-conservative condensed matter physicist.
Yeah.
I believe I'm non-conservative. Get lost when you make this correspondence. For example, in the context of Mollesena, holography, and so there is a dictionary which you give, and you use the dictionary to translate. Whereas in simple solid-state systems, like this, simple in some sense, you should be able to construct the dictionary.
Uh-huh.
Like you started with elasticity theory and motivated.
Yeah.
But then when you jump to holographic world, we get lost.
So, yeah, let me try to...
In fact, you will encounter this when you meet condensed matter audience. And I find in this, probably I'm the only condensed matter audience. I just wanted to make...
Yeah. Let me try to tell you my take on the subject. So my take on is then when I see something like this kind of plot, so I see that there is a feature which is, let's say, very general and not really dependent on the microscopic of the system. So the systems are very different, and I see the same kind of feature. So I believe that this kind of feature has nothing to do with the details of the microscopic of the theory. Once we agree on that, we agree that what just matter, it's basically at the level of the symmetries and nothing else. It can...
No, then you take recourse to holography. That is, where does it come from? Because you...
No, but that's...
A big burden.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to say. That you have to take holography, for example, in this case, just as a tool or something like that. Nothing, I'm not discussing if holography is true, what it's describing. I'm just saying that, for example, in these kind of things, holography, it's very, very efficient in computing, for example, Green functions and linear response.
That
yeah, that's exactly what I'm claiming. That's exactly a tool. But what is the, I don't know, the Abbar model? Isn't that a tool? Is it true the Abbar model is wrong?
For example, no, within non-relativistic Hamiltonian, you can approximately derive Abbar. You may not be able to solve Abbar, but you can motivate. So there is a background of non-relativistic Hamiltonian. However complicated it is, you can come to some effective models.
Yeah, exactly. But
holographic world.
Let me try to understand. So, for example, when you write an Hamiltonian, what is the guiding principle? The symmetry.
Experiment. Exactly. In fact,
okay.
If you take look at phenomena, for example, for Einstein,
okay.
He wrote down his oscillator model from experiment. He found that specifically. Was becoming exponentially smaller, low temperature. So he postulated oscillators.
Okay.
In the same way, for many profound condensed matter phenomena, it's an experiment which guide you to write Hamiltonian, which can be derived later using RG and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So, having used that way of doing things, very often condensed matter physics get lost. I just wanted to.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Okay, trying to understand it.
Okay, but let me just also mention that all the computation that I show here, from here on, is nothing to do with holography. So this is pure condensed matter computation. And of course, there is no appeal to microscopics, but that's exactly why I think this is powerful. Because I can derive, basically, the feature that you see in a lot of things without relying on microscopics. For example, I don't need to see if there is a two-level system or something like that. And actually, since you comment on that, that's really where these kind of things fail. Because in an ordered crystal, where is the two-level state? That's clearly not two-level state because it's not a disordered system or not. It's not a glass, right? So all these models, actually one of the models that I put here.
We could discuss that indeed.
Okay, maybe we can discuss it afterwards.
The end of the...
Sure.
Yeah, we can discuss it after.
Sorry.
No, it's okay.
Because I have to go for a condensed matter seminar.
No, it's very nice to, you know, have a, that's exactly what I wanted to provoke. Anyway, let's just go to the end because it's a more basic question, which I will show you is not very basic. So while you were trying to listen to me, did you think about what is a solid and what is a liquid and what's the difference? So that's a bit what I encountered by myself. So when I learned about the difference between solid and liquids, I was thinking, okay, if there is a transverse phonon propagating, so a shear wave, an elastic response, that's a solid. And liquids, they don't have anything like that. But then I discovered that that was quite totally wrong, and it was known since a long time ago, so since the work of Frankl. For example, it's known that if you probe a liquid at very high frequency, the liquids behave like a solid. And what I mean by behave like a solid, I mean that there are not only longitudinal waves, but also transverse. And when I think about liquids, I'm not thinking about something very exotic. I'm not thinking about any holographic whatever. This is just water. So I take water, I do an experiment, I shear it at very high frequency, and water does not behave like a liquid, as you think. It behaves like a solid where you have both longitudinal and transverse waves. Now, this is known, and this was known a long time ago, but there is more. And there is more because more recently, in Paris, the group of Noiret did some experiment in liquids at very low frequency. Let me try to guide you, since you are almost all high energy, what we are talking about. So this experiment is very simple. You take a liquid in the middle of two plates, and you start shearing the liquids with a periodic force, OK? And here you can see, basically, you apply this shear strain, and you look at what is the stress for the response in the material. This is the most typical experiment that soft matter people and the rheology people do. So now, what you can understand is that if there is an elastic response, imagine you have a solid where the response is purely elastic, the response will be immediate. There will be no delay. So the two curves will just be overlapping together. Now, on the contrary, if you take a fluid, a purely viscous fluid, the response will be delayed, and the phase delay, so the angle between these two, let's say, oscillations, will be exactly 90 degrees. OK? Furthermore, the response can be formalized in terms of what is called the complex dynamical modulus, which in the language of high energy is nothing else than the correlator of the stress tensor again. So what condensed matter people like to talk about it is what they call G prime and G second. So G prime is just nothing else than the real part of the correlator, and G second is the imaginary part. So just to tell you a bit better, imagine we compute the stress tensor correlator in the shear sector. So at low energy, this correlator will start with a constant, which is basically the shear modulus, the elastic modulus, and then we'll have a first correction, which comes from the viscosity. Okay, so this is the generic form, and then of course you will have higher order correction. Now, what they mean by G prime is basically just this term, and what they mean by G second is basically this term. Now, what they do here is that they generalize it frequency dependent. So basically, they take this object as an object in function of frequency, and they plot just the real part and the imaginary part. The real part is the elastic part, it's not dissipative, and the G second is the dissipative part. So now, that said, let's look at this experiment. So this experiment took a liquid and compute basically the response. And what you can see here. So first of all, what you can see here is that the response is completely in phase with the strain that I'm applying. And second, if you check at the two contributions, you will realize that the real part, it's much, much bigger than the imaginary part. So this liquid, if we still call a liquid, behaves exactly like a solid. So this is exactly what you would expect from the elastic response of a solid. And the amazing thing is that this happens at low frequency. So you can see this is frequency. You can go almost at zero frequency. And that's exactly what you see. So what's going on here? What's the catch? How we can explain this? Okay. So the catch is that the distance here, so the length scale, are very, very, very small. So here, basically, what we are going to probe is not very high frequency, like Frankl was doing here, but it's high momentum, very high momentum. And now the point is, how can we explain what we see? So there is one proposal that was done by one of my collaborators, an FMR collaborator, which is the following. What if the dispersion relation of the phonon is in this liquid is actually something like that? So what do you mean something like that? Something like that, what is this kind of dispersion relation? So this is the dispersion relation that you would expect from a massive particle with a tachyonic mass. OK, so instead of having the usual dispersion relation of this kind, of a massive particle, now we have something like this. OK? And this, it's what we call K-gap. OK? So if now the dispersion relation is of this kind, so here, for example, I plot some examples, what you will see is that at low momenta, So at very large distances, there is no wave propagating. Take, for example, the red curve. Okay, if you are sitting here, at low momenta, you won't see anything propagate. There is no propagating mode. But now, if you go to momenta very high, you will see that there is an emergent mode which starts propagating. And then, of course, if this is true, if you compute the response, let's say, here, then, of course, this material will behave like a solid and not like a liquid. So the take on is that basically liquids and solids are not qualitatively different. The only difference between liquid and solid is quantitative. It's where you're looking at in terms of time scale and length scale. And the nice things that we did together is that to try to understand a bit how far we can go with this kind of relation and how exotic it is. So let me guide you through the various things. So this is a numerical simulation. It's a molecular dynamic simulation that he did with some collaborator where you can actually see the dispersion relation of this kind. So what they do is they do a simulation where they assume a potential, a certain potential which works pretty well for this kind of system, and they make it evolve numerically, and then they can compute basically the spectral function, and that's exactly what you see, the dispersion relation. Now, just to get back a bit to holography, if you these kind of plots here are computed through holography. So this is a system, a holographic system, that just by symmetries is supposed to be a liquid. But now, when you go in a sufficiently, let's say, precise parameter space, you will see that actually the dispersion relation becomes to be exactly of this kind. So it's exactly of this kind. And there are also a lot of relation between what is basically this tau here, which is called relaxation time for the liquids, the tau computed in the experiments, and the tau computed holographically. So this tau, let me try to tell you a bit what is the physical intuition. The physical intuition is that if you are in a liquid, so the particles do not actually vibrate much, but they can also jump around diffusing. And this time is basically the average time of, let's say, reorganization of the molecules in the liquids. Okay? So,
sorry.
Yeah.
But it's actually a generic thing. Pretty much any holographic horizon will have this feature, right? So you're talking about the shear channel quasi-normal mode, and at high enough frequency, so that becomes propagated.
No, but let me tell you.
Sorry, at high enough momentum.
There is a big difference. So the big difference is the following. So the usual holographic thing, let me show you. So shear sector, here I plot the imaginary part, imaginary omega in function of momenta, and here up, I plot the real part. Okay? So this is the imaginary and the real. So the imaginary part at low momenta will have the diffusive mode going down, and then there will be another sound mode, which is, of course, sound mode in the sense is not hydrodynamic, of course. They will do something like this, and there are others. And this is exactly what you're saying. There is a mode that the high momenta becomes very, very, almost not damped, and here on the real part, that's the difference. On the real part, you don't see something like that. What you see is basically you see a mode that does like this. And there are asymptotes, omega ul k, at large moment. But this is clearly a mode which is not low frequency. It's not, let's say, a low energetic mode. So you will see a bunch of these. Actually, there is a bunch of these. It's not just one, but it's very different from this behavior, where actually these modes start like this. And I will show you in a while what is the difference between this behavior and this behavior, because it can be understood in the realm of quasi hydrodynamics. So just to be fast, we realized it after we wrote the paper. This is, you know, when you start searching things on Google to see if somebody did it or if it's your amazing idea. Well, actually, it was not our amazing idea. There was already something outside, but in a completely different framework. And the completely different framework was plasma. So if you consider plasma, so basically electromagnetic waves in a medium, what you will discover is that this kind of dispersion relation appear. And here there are two papers that are actually quite old where this dispersion relation appear. So you can see here, this is a simulation of a plasma, and you see again this dispersion relation. And these are also simulation in a plasma, and you see this kind of dispersion relation. Why I'm telling you this? Because we are now trying to write a review where we classify all the possible places where these kind of things happen. And as you can see in the next slide, there are a lot. So this goes back to hydrodynamics and what happened. So there was a recent paper, which is, I find very interesting, that explained why this kind of feature should be quite universal in some cases. And the point is the following. We think about hydrodynamics as the effective field theory that describes basically conserved quantum. So you have conserved current, a bunch of conserved current, And basically, the low energy description of this system is nothing else than hydrodynamics. But now, instead of taking this example, imagine that there is one operator, one current, which is not conserved. So this current is not conserved, and this conservation is just broken by a relaxation time, which is supposed to be small. So this is what these authors call quasi-hydrodynamics. Now, if you consider this system and you solve it, you will realize it immediately that what happened at the level of the modes is a situation like this. So there is a collision between two modes, an hydrodynamic mode and a non-hydrodynamic mode, that they collide and they produce a real part. And this is exactly the situation that happens when we have basically the K gap that I was, exactly, this K gap. On the contrary, what Alex was saying is the situation where these things happen. And this is quite different. So in the shear mode, usually what happens is that you have a mode which is hydro that goes down. This is just a diffusive mode that goes down. And you have another mode that goes up, and there is a crossover. But the point is that these modes do not collide, because the non-hydro mode has a finite real part even at zero momentum. And so there is no collision. And of course, if there is no collision, you cannot have anything like that. So basically, this is nothing else than the merging of these two modes coming from this collision. And this is indeed the dispersion relation that you can get analytically getting, you know, analyzing this kind of system. So if you're interested, I encourage you to get to that paper, which is quite recent. Now, since I'm telling you that, you know, at the first time I was showing this dispersion relation, they were like, what is that? It's very exotic or whatever. So there are people, and we had an example that they say is everywhere, and there are people that actually say, what is that? It's very exotic. And the answer is a bit in the middle, but this is another, let's say, very nice place where this happens. So I don't know if you are familiar with anomalous transport, so let me just give you a tip. So there are systems in condensed matter which are very well described by fermions, fermionic state, massless fermionic state, and even relativistic in some cases. Graphene is one of the most famous examples, while semi-metals are other examples. Now, since the system, at least in some regime, is described by fermions, it gets all the possible properties of fermions, including all the anomalies. And the anomalies can have a very huge impact on transport. And there are a set of new transport coefficients that actually are determined directly by the anomalies and have been experimentally observed in, for example, by semi-metal MOSFETs. To make it short, in this kind of system, there is a wave that appears, which is called Chirac magnetic wave. This is nothing else than due to the anomaly of the U1 axial. So imagine you have two gauge fields, an axial gauge field and the vector gauge field. Now we know that the axial gauge field gets an anomaly, okay? And therefore, the anomaly coefficient is kappa in this language. Now, let's apply a magnetic field to this system. And what you will get is that basically this anomaly is basically coupling together this axial and vector modes. And the equation looks very simple, like nothing else than this. And the equation itself, then you can try to think by yourself, okay, I have an axial anomaly and I have a vector field. And in principle, both of them, both of the current, or if you want the density, so this rho here, should be conserved. So these are both conserved. That one is anomalous, but they're both conserved. So now you would expect that if a charge is conserved, basically it's just diffuse. It's just diffuse. You could just fit low. But now you realize that in realistic material, actually the axial charge is also broken. So it's not conserved, the axial charge. Why it's not conserved? So in vice semi-metal, for example, what makes these kind of things not conserved is scattering. There is an interval of scattering that relaxes this kind of charge. In quark-gluon plasma, for example, that is a high-energy system, what should break this kind of conservation are basically defects of gluon, so defects of the strong interactions. But in both cases, and notice these are completely different cases, vice semi-metal, we are talking about low-energy physics, and quark-gluon plasma, we're talking about high energy physics. So this is again an example of connection between low energy and high energy. And once you assume this, we end up again in the same picture of before. So this is what we call quasi-hydrodynamics. If you solve this system, imagine what you will get. You will get exactly these things. And what you get indeed again a transition between a purely diffusive and something which propagates with a collision. So you see the structure, it's again exactly the same kind of structure.
Why do you break this proportional to rho? Maybe is
there a simple way to understand that? Yes, this is just a linear. It's like imagine the easiest way. It's of course there are other terms, this is just the first term in the bracket. So we are doing basically an expansion. Also, when I write here, for example, this is the prostitutive relation, I start in an expansion. So of course, you will have more derivatives then. This is basically the low energy, the first term. If you want to think about this kind of dispersion relation, this kind of relation is nothing else than if you want the Drude model. So if you think about the Drude model, so a model where momentum is not conserved, what you will write down is exactly an equation of that kind. And this would be basically the relaxation time. So every quantity which is relaxed, where the relaxation time is actually small, the equation governing that is exactly that. Is if you want this, you can think about it, but it's quite natural if you think about it. So this is another place where we found these things. And now just to conclude, I will just give you some tip about other places that we are putting all together in this review we are writing. So first of all, why it's interesting, dispersion relation? Because it can be one of the possible explanation of these mysterious experiments that try to, you know, clarify what is a liquid and what is a solid. So let me tell you that, again, this idea, amazing idea, is not ours. This appeared already in Maxwell's book. And indeed, it can be derived from Navier-Stokes equation just using what is called Maxwell interpolation. So if you are curious about it, I can tell you offline. Then it's found it's formalized in this quasi-hydrodynamic business. And there are several examples of this quasi-hydrodynamic business. For those of you who are familiar with hydrodynamics, one of these frameworks is actually Israel-Stewart. And it is actually so the reason why, if you want, the reason why this dispersion relation has to appear, it's nothing else because of causality and unitarity of basically first order hydrodynamics. It has to be like that, because if the diffusive mode will live forever, causality will get lost, because we will have a mode which will propagate with superluminal speed at high moment. Now, there is much more. So I show you very fast that this happened in plasma. It happened in hydrodynamics. It can be derived more formally with Kelly-Schwinger formalism. It appears in holographic models. It appears in anomalous transport. I didn't show you, but we actually realized that if you take Sine-Gordon model, so Sine-Gordon model is just basically a field, a scalar field on a psi potential, and you solve it, you will find that the dispersion relation in some regime is exactly of this kind, which is kind of amazing because it is a very controllable and very well-known model. Still, I didn't find any discussion about that. So more experimentally, it has been observed in plasmas, in experiment. Can it be maybe observed in chiral magnetic waves? Experiments are coming. People are quite, let's say, confident that these chiral magnetic waves have to be there. Of course, we have just to wait for the development in the technology to detect them. And just for your curiosity, next March, there will be a big experiment in liquids at ISIS in Oxford. So ISIS is a neutron scattering facility in Oxford, where they will try actually, okay, the name is very, very bad, but anyway, they will try to make the experiments, the scattering experiment in liquids to see if they can detect this dispersion relation. So just stay tuned because we can have maybe another confirmation, another experimental confirmation. So I'm almost done. Before I leave you, I wanna advertise another little thing that I'm doing, which has to deal with physics, but in another way. So this is a project, it's called the Grumpy Scientist, and it's a project that we are actually, so thanks Perimeter for the advertising, I don't know where is the camera. But anyway, so this is a project that we are doing to raise awareness on some problems linked with academia, which are serious problems, much more serious than understanding if this is a liquid or this is a solid. So I'm talking about problem of instability, depression, mental illness, which are linked to basically the life that I think all of us are familiar or have been familiar in the past. And so we have a Facebook page and a website and a bunch of very annoying and funny stories and sketches. And this is just to say that basically, you know, all this grumpiness for which we are famous, maybe it's not completely unmotivated, but there is some motivation which is actually profound. So if you want to help us, you know, raising a bit some awareness about this problem, just visit the website and you will find a lot of fun. And you can find also, as you can see, t-shirts. So you can also be part of our stories. So that said, thanks for listening, and that's it.
Questions for Matteo?
Thank you. somebody running green.
I think I agree. So I have a question. So normally on Ethereum RG we have some axioms, right? We want to write some down some Hamiltonians that are local, unitary, etc. So the first, at least for equilibrium phenomena, like the first part of your talk. So if you in ADS CMT, aren't you basically giving up on locality? Can you make some comments about that?
Let me see. No, I would say no, because the picture, of course, the locality you wanna keep is the locality of your description in the boundary, right? Your physical system lives at the boundary. Now, I agree with you that you are describing in a way that it looks very unlocal because you're describing some fields in the boundary in a bulk with an extra dimension. So the description itself is still very local, but the would be Hamiltonian would be the one living at the boundary, which of course you don't have access to. But you believe that that Hamiltonian has to be local, of course. I understand that, you know, in conform, for example, if it's a conformal field theory, it doesn't even make sense completely what is the Hamiltonian, what is the action, right? You don't even write down an action. So it goes even farther. But I would say that these kind of like things like unitarity, locality, and whatever, you don't want to get rid of them.
Any more questions from Matteo?
So when you show the dispersion relation about the liquid, why there's no measurement?
Okay, yes, because I've been sloppy and I show you just the real part. Yeah, you can see, actually I can show you very very simply what it is. Yeah, so the generic, I can write it. So the generic equation that you will solve is basically this equation. Omega squared plus C squared K squared plus I omega over tau. Equals zero. That's a generic equation, okay? Where this tau enter. Can you see? Then if you solve this equation, you will get basically an imaginary part and the real part. The real part is exactly the square root of C squared K squared minus 1 over 4 tau squared. And then there is a real part, an imaginary part, which is exactly this minus 1 over 2 tau, minus I over 2 tau. Actually, I show you here, this is the best picture. This is the best picture you can see here. So here, for example, you can see both the real part and the imaginary part of generic solution. So you see that the real part is described by this square root, but it's not all. There is, of course, an imaginary part. But when you talk about propagating modes, you're not very interested in the imaginary part. But yeah, I've been just sloppy. What I show you, it was like the real part of the sequence. Yes.
Can you get the collision between
the. So the collision, you have to think that the mode lives in the complex plane. Okay? So at a certain point, so the modes start at zero momentum, you have the modes here. Okay? So they have zero real part and imaginary part, some imaginary part. Okay? And then when you start increasing momentum, these two modes, the imaginary parts, you see that they collide to each other. So basically, if you plot the full imaginary real, so this is real, this is imaginary. Okay? So you start from a situation where you are here. You have a pole here and the pole here, which is exactly this situation. Okay? And they have zero real part. Okay? Now I increase momentum. What happens is this mode goes down and this mode goes up. And this you can see here. Okay. Actually use this. So you can see that one mode goes down and the other goes up. Okay, still with zero real parts. At a certain point, which is exactly the point where they collide. There is a collision, so they collide. They collide, let's say, here. Okay? When they collide, so you can immediately understand what's happening because of the symmetry of the Green function. So the Green function has to be symmetric in K minus K. So the only thing that you can do is that basically you can produce a pair. Okay? So when you produce a pair, you produce a pair that goes in this direction. Okay? So this pair now has the same imaginary part. Okay? But it has a real part that grows. And that's exactly what you see here. So basically, they merge together. And then the real part starts to become huge. And of course, one is propagating one direction, and the other is propagating the other direction. So these are basically the two modes.
Okay? How do you determine what they are made? There is a spectrum effect. 0.5.
Okay, what determines that? That's a good question. So what determines that, so for example, if you look here, you can see where this happened. So this collision happens when the momentum is basically 1 over c tau. Now, what is tau? So tau, phenomenologically, is this relaxation time in the liquid. In the holographic models, I can compute that. And why I can compute that, I can show you. So the point is that you know something more. So when you have the full dispersion relation, right, which is basically this is the full dispersion relation, minus I over 2 gamma to tau plus minus square root of c squared k squared minus 1 over 4 gamma squared, I to tau squared. Okay? So now you say, that's all I know. It's not true. You know more. And why you know more? Because if you go at low momenta, the mode that you expect is a diffusive mode, like this. Okay? So now you can expand this function, this solution that you get at low momentum. And you will see that there is a term which goes exactly like this. And therefore, you can identify basically what is tau in function of basically c and d. For example, if you are in a relativistic theory, you know that c is 1. And if I remember well by heart, you will get that d tau is d over c squared when you expand these things. Maybe there is a 2 or a 4, but OK, forget about it. So for example, you will see that in a relativistic system, this tau would be exactly proportional to d. And d, for example, in relativistic hydrodynamics, is just 1 over 4 pi t. Because d is eta over s in relativistic hydrodynamics. OK? So eta over s in this kind of super relativistic strongly coupled things is 1 over 4 pi. And you get exactly 1 over 4 pi t. And that's roughly speaking, what you get here. So you can see, for example, that in this plot, I plot the log of tau in function of 1 over t, and you see that these things grow. OK? So this is actually the approximation that happened. OK?
OK, let's take that. Let's think. OK.